Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand. Two masters of the trade, conversation hot, you need a fan. It's Legal Face Off, so step into the ring. No topic off limit, cause they gon' cover everything. Now check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Like and follow, because we don't wanna miss ya. Introducing your host, Christina and Rich. Legal Face Off is about to begin.
We welcome you into Legal Face Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com with Rich Lankov and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich, and as always, plenty to get to. We'll talk about prosecuting leakers, law firms potentially becoming obsolete, and of course, the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we lead things off with a return guest, our friend. He's a professor of law emeritus at Harvard Law School, Alan Dershowitz. He joins us to lead off Legal Face Off. Hello, Professor.
Hey, how are you? Good.
Thanks so much for joining us. Talk to us about your feelings on the news recently that Robert Mueller has began using a grand jury in Washington as part of his investigation into the possible coordination between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it certainly gives Mueller a tactical advantage, having the case in the District of Columbia, which is 95% Democrat, rather than Virginia, which is a swing state, and although it's gone Democrat, is only Democrat by maybe 55 to 45%. And any jury consultant, and we'll use jury consultants, would tell you that Mueller is better off if there is a trial of Trump or any of Trump associates. He's better off in the District of Columbia with that jury pool than he would be in Virginia with the jury pool in Virginia. But when I said that, Maxine Waters called me a racist for just describing something that anybody who knows anything about jurors or jury consultants would agree with. Keith Olbermann called me a whore. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, refused to answer whether I was a racist or not for making that kind of statement. It shows you where we've come, that you can't have reasoned argument or discourse. It's all come down to name-calling. And I want you to all think about if the opposite had happened, if Hillary Clinton had been elected and she were being prosecuted and investigated in the District of Columbia, and then the special prosecutor moved the grand jury from the District of Columbia to Virginia, all the same people who are attacking me would be saying, oh, this is terrible. It gives an advantage to the prosecutor when Hillary Clinton is being the subject to have a case in Virginia rather than in District of Columbia, which is more Democratic. So, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot, people would be making very, very different kinds of arguments. There's so much hypocrisy that comes with partisan politics, and people forget about civil liberties and the rule of law.
So, Professor, how do you see this process unfolding? We've had the impaneling, and what can we expect in the coming weeks and months?
Well, we don't know, because it's all going to be behind closed doors. This was the worst possible mechanism for getting to the bottom of Russian collusion. The best mechanism would have been to appoint an independent, nonpartisan commission like the 9/11 Commission to get to the bottom through public hearings, open hearings, with what the Russians tried to do, how they tried to influence the election, what impact it may have had, was there any cooperation with the Trump campaign. Now we're not going to know anything for a year or more than a year. There's going to be secret grand jury investigations. Maybe we'll have a leak or two. But in the end, all we'll hear is whether there's an indictment or not an indictment. So it's not the best mechanism. In fact, it's the worst mechanism for getting at the truth and trying to prevent the recurrence of Russian influence on American elections. So I think there was a big mistake in appointing a special counsel and a big mistake in not having a nonpartisan commission.
Chris Wallace on Sunday asked Deputy Attorney General, Acting Attorney General for this investigation, Rod Rosenstein, isn't it true that a federal grand jury is impaneled with the explicit intent to prosecute someone? He sort of dodged the question. What are your thoughts on whether the intent when you gather a grand jury is inevitably to indict someone?
Not always. You need a grand jury to investigate. You know, prosecutors don't have subpoena power. Only the grand jury has subpoena power. Of course, prosecutors use the grand jury like a plaything. As somebody once said, prosecuting get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. But Having said that, when you have a special counsel or a special prosecutor, and they spend a fortune of money and hire an enormous number of very talented lawyers, and they come up with nothing, I think they fear they would go down in history as having wasted a lot of the taxpayers' money. So when you have a special prosecutor, a special counsel, there is an incentive to indict somebody. Whereas when you have a regular prosecutor, they go to work every day, sometimes they prosecute, sometimes they don't, but they don't have a particular target. And what I worry about is I don't want to ever see our country become what happened in the terrible days of Stalin and the Soviet Union, when the head of the KGB said to Stalin, "Show me the man and I'll find you the crime." If you have a target, if you're going after somebody first, you know, you can find crimes. My friend Harvey Silverberg wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day, where he shows that you can find three felonies committed by almost anybody who's in a complicated business or political life. And the object is not to suddenly find crime because you've targeted somebody you don't like politically, but to make sure that if you're going to go after somebody, they've actually committed crimes under the federal statutes. And I don't see that right now. Maybe it'll develop over time, but I don't see crimes certainly involving President Trump, who I voted against.
So to that point, and I think I know your answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway. We learned this week, yesterday, that Paul Manafort, who is the formerly he was the campaign manager for Trump, we learned that the FBI, in a pre-dawn raid, unbeknownst to him, with no notice, raided his house and brought back lots of documents related to who knows what. Maybe the potential collusion with Russia, but, you know, maybe involving some other business dealings. I think, again, I know what your answer is, but is that an appropriate use of Mueller's time and the taxpayers' money?
If they had probable cause to believe two things. Number one, that there was evidence of criminal conduct in his house. And number two, that he would have not responded to a subpoena for that material. There's a real advantage in a search warrant over a subpoena. A subpoena, you can claim your Fifth Amendment. A search warrant, you can't claim any Fifth Amendment. You're not involved in the process. They just gather the evidence. That's why a subpoena can be issued without probable cause, and a search warrant requires probable cause. It's able to close a very, very low standard, and most federal judges, magistrate judges, hand out search warrants like they're Christmas presents. So it doesn't provide a sufficient safeguard for privacy of individuals, but using a search warrant is not unusual in situations like this. There certainly should be a preference for subpoenas over search warrants, but I'm not surprised that they use the search warrant.
Professor Dershowitz, our next guest, will be talking about whether the government should be going after leakers and the method by which you can prosecute leakers. This is, of course, in the wake of Trump coming out strongly, Sessions coming out, and Rosenstein talking about that. What are your thoughts on, you know, going after reporters, going after White House and congressional employees for leaks?
Well, I would make a sharp distinction between reporters who should not be gone after. Reporters are entitled to use information given to them by leaks. That's protected by the First Amendment. But certainly government employees who are sworn to secrecy and sometimes have access to classified material shouldn't be leaking. And a terrible, terrible precedent was set when the former head of the FBI himself, James Comey, leaked material after he left office. He leaked material and laundered it through a law profession. That should never have happened. The FBI is supposed to stop leaks, not supposed to set a precedent for having leaks. I would distinguish between two kinds of leaks. Very commonly, there are leaks that are just designed to make somebody look good, make your political opponent look bad. But then there are leaks of classified material. For example, when somebody leaked the fact that the Israelis may have uncovered the laptop explosives and leaked the name of the city where Israel may have had a spy or a bug planted, and they leaked to the Washington Post. That was a tremendous breach of national security. Whoever did that should be prosecuted, should be in prison. I don't blame the Washington Post for printing it, but I strongly blame whoever the national security person was who leaked that, because that may result in plane flying up in the air. it's our effort to try to stop laptop computers from having explosives has been in any way compromised by that leak, it would be a terrible, terrible thing.
It's time for the heavy hitters. I sat around a fire with a corncob pipe and thought about these questions because they're very important to me. We need to know the first car you bought and your favorite album.
Well, I didn't buy a car until I was quite old because I was poor. I grew up in a poor family. And the first car I bought was a Volvo, which lasted me a long time. The first car I actually drove was a classic 1955 Chevy. It was my uncle's car, not mine, but I got to use it, and it was great. I wish I had held on to it. Those classics are now worth a bloody fortune.
And then how about the favorite album?
I think Leonard Cohen. I've always loved Leonard Cohen's music. He was about my age, maybe a couple of years older. And even before he became famous by singing Hallelujah, I loved his dark, dark music and his most recent album just before he died. I think it's called Do You Want to Get Darker? Is brilliant. So Leonard Cohen, I wish he had gotten the Nobel Prize with Bob Dylan. I wanted actually three people to get the Nobel Prize. Bob Dylan, maybe four. The Living Beatles and Paul Simon, along with Bob Dylan. I think they revolutionized the modern literature of music, and I love them all.
That's Alan Dershowitz, professor at Harvard Law School for over 50 years. He's on Twitter, too, at Alan Dersh. And the new book about President Trump comes out next week, we understand?
It's coming out next week. It's called Trumped Up, and its subtitle is How the Criminalization of Political Differences Endangers Democracy.
We always appreciate having you on. Thanks again, Professor.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, and you can follow the show on iTunes, get a fresh episode once we post it. As we move along and talk about prosecuting leakers, and to do that, we bring in Heidi Kotroser, who's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. Hello, Professor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said on Sunday that anyone responsible for leaking classified information could face federal prosecution. This would include people in the White House and members of Congress. Tell us your thoughts on that, Professor.
Well, first, just a little bit of background. A lot of people don't realize that the United States does not actually have an official Secrets Act that automatically makes it a crime to leak classified information. We do, however, have the Espionage Act, which is so broadly worded that it has something close to that same effect. Historically, there have been very, very few prosecutions. There was a ramp up in the Obama administration, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see one as foreshadowed by the press conference in the Trump administration. My thoughts are I think it's very troubling. The Espionage Act is extremely broad. It lends itself to prosecuting virtually any leaked classified information. The fact is, experts across the political spectrum have long agreed that there's massive overclassification, and journalism really couldn't exist as we know it if there wasn't, if there weren't people leaking things to the press. It's the lifeblood of journalism, and so this indicia of wide-ranging efforts to prosecute, I think, is quite troubling.
So what do you think is the potential for bad case law here? As you mentioned, Professor, it's really a slippery slope between going after leakers and then not going after the journalists and the media sources that make it evident that there has been a leak?
Right. Well, I think there are two issues that you get at. You know, one is the implication directly for journalists, and then two is the implications for the leakers themselves, which, of course, indirectly very much affects journalism. In terms of journalists, I think that there is a real slippery slope. It's not a very stable line between going after leakers and going after journalists. So, for example, during the Obama administration, it came out a couple of years after the fact that the Obama administration had sought a warrant to obtain email account information of a journalist, James Rosen of Fox News. And in that warrant application, they referred to him as a co-conspirator, indicating it's really hard to draw that line between prosecuting leakers, prosecuting journalists. But then there's also the issue of going after leakers themselves, which, again, is, I think, very problematic and does have the potential to make for very chilling case law.
Professor, in addition to the appearance of the acting attorney general for this issue, Rosenstein, on Friday of last week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced some Justice Department actions to go after leaks of classified information. I don't know if you saw that, but it almost looked like a hostage film. You know, given all of the criticism that Trump has had over the last couple of weeks about Sessions, it seemed as though this might have just been his attempt to keep his job and his attempt to impress his boss, rather than him really believing that these measures were necessary. That just might be my interpretation, but what do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I actually read a transcript of the press conference, but your description now makes me want to, sorry, there's a little bit of hallway noise here, but your description makes me eager to go back and actually see what it looked like. But even without seeing the video, you know, I don't think it took a lot of imagination to think that part of what was going on was that Sessions was trying to impress his boss. And, you know, that gets to something very important. There have long been norms presidents being very careful not to create even the appearance of improper political pressure upon the Justice Department.
Not Trump. Not anymore, right?
Exactly. It's the end of times, or the end of norms, at least. And, you know, so it does raise that troubling question. Now, it's not inappropriate for a president to sort of lay out a big picture agenda that the Attorney General and the Justice Department might have in mind as they go about, you know, prosecuting and setting priorities. But there's a really fine line there. And in the case of President Trump, you know, he hasn't just said go after leakers in general. He's also named names at times, referred to particular leaks that he'd like to see gone after. And that is a real breach of norms.
So how do you figure out who a leak is whenever information gets leaked by the press, you know, or they find something out and then they report it? How do you even go about figuring out where the leak is? And then I think it would be helpful if we take a couple seconds for our listeners to just go through what the potential ramifications are if you're found and prosecuted to be a leaker.
Sure. Well, in terms of the process, I mean, essentially it's, you know, the ordinary investigative tools that you know, one might use to figure out, you know, basically any potential criminal act. But that said, you know, as I mentioned, there was a big ramp up of prosecutions in the Obama administration, and there's been no end. It was no end of kind of speculation as to why, what's different now, what calls for sort of this change numerically. But I think it's more than one factor, but I think there's no question that one reason is that it is easier to catch leakers now than it used to be. You know, think about technological changes. In the past, you might meet someone in an alleyway. Today, even if you do that, there are monitors everywhere, right? People have electronic badges that they use to sign in and out of their government agency workplaces, plus telephone calls are much easier to trace, email communications. We leave so many digital footprints. So I think those are factors, those investigative factors, are part of what creates a more chilling environment potentially for leakers and the journalists that they work with. In terms of what happens to you if you're prosecuted, well, you know, essentially you could be facing, you know, very serious consequences, including jail time, long periods of time in jail under the Espionage Act. One leaker, for example, that the Obama administration went after, and this was an investigation that began in the Bush administration, was Thomas Drake. He ultimately had a plea agreement to a relatively minor offense, but when the government went after him, you know, he said they told him, we're going to put you away for the rest of your life. So there's a lot to fear if you're prosecuted.
Professor, that brings us to the last question, and we appreciate your time on Legal Face-Off. We've heard the term treason thrown around a lot lately in the wake of the leaks and in the wake of Trump's announcement that he's going after leakers. Certainly the supporters of Trump have called these leaks an act of treason. Legally, do you agree? What is treason legally? And do these leaks qualify as, you know, an act against the government that would qualify as treason?
Right. Well, my guess is it's certainly untested, the notion of going after a leaker on the basis of treason. There is, you know, a lot of debate about what exactly constitutes treason. My guess is, to the extent that term's being thrown around, it's for rhetorical and political purposes, that what they will, you know, probably do is what has historically been done in the handful of leak cases, which is pursue them under the Espionage Act. And or the small handful of other statutes that, you know, also provide more directly for going after the communication of classified or closely held national defense information.
That's Professor Heidi Katroser from the University of Minnesota Law School. Also, she wrote a book. It's award-winning, Reclaiming Accountability, Transparency, Executive Power, and the U.S. Constitution. Thank you for your time on WGN.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
We welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. Joining us now, he's Mark Cohen, a distinguished lecturer of law at Georgetown, a Forbes columnist, and a global speaker of the legal industry. Hello, Mark. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Mark, you have written a lot and contributed much to the thought leadership on law firms and the law firm model. You recently wrote a Forbes article on why law firms are becoming obsolete. Why don't you share with us a thumbnail sketch as to why you think law firms are becoming obsolete?
Sure. And let me just qualify that I mean law firms as they are presently structured, and the traditional partnership model is what is fast becoming obsolete, not the notion that law firms in and of themselves are necessarily destined for obsolescence. It's really a question of the model, the fact that law firms were built on leverage, which in turn was built on billable hours and high rates, and really taking a brute force approach to the service of legal delivery. What's changed is technology, globalization, and a very different buy-sell dynamic, which is now increasingly separating out the practice of law, the core things that lawyers really need to do, from the business of law, which is everything else. Lawyers and law firms tend to be really good at practice, but they're not so good in terms of delivery. And I think that's why so much work is being taken in-house. And so much work is also going to a new crop of legal service providers that are providing those business of law services that used to be performed by law firms.
Mark, the traditional law firm model that you're referring to relies heavily on younger attorneys, younger associates who are coming in with not a lot of experience, yet are given, you know, tremendous responsibilities and are billing at very high rates. Your article touches on that a lot of, you know, that model not working as well as it used to. Why do you think that?
Well, there are several reasons for it. First and foremost, clients are putting their foot down and saying, we are not going to pay $300, $400, $500 an hour for on-the-job training. And unfortunately, law schools have historically not done a very good job of making their graduates practice ready. Until about 10 years ago, that was a secret that was very well known and pretty much condoned. It's not anymore. So that's one factor. And therefore, you're seeing fewer numbers of law school graduates going to in-house, law firm departments. Just to give you an example, I can speak to two of the top 14 law schools from personal experience. I won't name them, but I can simply say that up until 4 years ago, 80% of their graduates went to large law firms. Today, that number is down to 50%. And I've told both deans that I think the number is probably going to go down to about 33% within the next 2 years.
Mark, you also speak in your June 12th article in Forbes of the generational divide that we see right now within law firms, particularly in the partnership ranks, and how that could adversely impact a firm's sustainability. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Well, that really refers to an element of the structure of law firms and the partnership structure. So in the partnership structure, basically what you have is rainmakers, the biggest rainmakers get the biggest share of the profits. There's very, very little reinvestment in law firms. And as a result, what you see is very often older partners within hailing distance of retirement are generally pretty reluctant to leave a lot of money on the table to reinvest in the law firm on the theory that, well, you know, I will just take the money and run. I'm going to be retiring in 3, 4, 5 years. And that's kind of the way it is, whereas younger partners who may not be as big rainmakers, ergo don't have the same vote at the management table, might have a very different view, but they're ultimately going to lose in almost all of those cases. That is one of the reasons, one of several reasons, why I think that you see a dramatic rise in the amount of work, the complexity of work that's being taken in-house. It's not just a labor arbitrage play, but rather it's that corporate legal departments really mimic the kind of corporate structures that the organizations that they work for have. And they do allow lawyers to have stock options, which promotes a kind of a long-term alignment of interest with the company that you don't see in law firms today. That's really, in my opinion, what's behind the generational divide that I speak of and write about.
Mark, last question on Legal Face-Off. We'll let you go. We really appreciate your time. You know, I'm going to jump on the get off my lawn soapbox here for a second because I've been in practice for over 20 years, and I'm an owner of a small firm here in Chicago. And I think one of the things that I see, especially with younger attorneys, is maybe a lack of a customer service perspective. You know, at the end of the day, I tell my attorneys all we're doing is selling a product. It could be hamburgers. It could be widgets. In our case, it happens to be legal services. What are your thoughts on the customer service element of the traditional law firm model and how that's evolving, and also your thoughts on, you know, I don't want to be the old man yelling at the kids coming to the practice, but how newer attorneys deal with customer service?
Sure. Well, I would say, first of all, I think you're offering good advice. The legal industry suffers from very poor customer service. This is not my opinion, but there have been any number of studies done recently. I just refer to a LexisNexis Cambridge University law school study that found that virtually none of the clients surveyed said that they could enthusiastically endorse any of their firms, even their go-to firms, for customer service. I would just take slight exception with your comment that it is mainly the millennials who are wanting for customer service skills. I would say that probably the blame could be equally applied. I think that legal culture, one of the many sort of challenges of legal culture, is a hubris and an arrogance that does not seem to often recognize the fact that lawyers are, as you point out, in a service business. People come to lawyers, whether they're individuals or large corporations, with problems. They're generally business problems with legal implications. But they are looking for help. They're looking for responsiveness. And I think that it is absolutely crucial that anyone in legal service, whether a lawyer or another type of professional, has got to have that first and foremost on his or her mind.
That's Mark Cohen. We appreciate your time. Thank you much.
Pleasure to be with you guys.
Time for the legal grab bag on Legal Face Off, our favorite part of the show. Seven topics, condom seven. And we start with our new, theme, Martin Shkreli, the pharma bro. He's guilty.
Yes, he's very guilty. Well, actually, only 10% guilty.
Not as guilty as he could have been.
Yes, he's only 10% guilty. So last Friday, Martin Shkreli, the pharma bro, was found guilty of two counts of securities fraud and one count of conspiracy to commit securities fraud, and not guilty on five other counts. The five-week-long jury trial in federal court in Brooklyn led to 5 days of jury deliberations. Shkreli, who was CEO at Turing Pharmaceuticals and was accused of hiking the price of the drug Daraprim by 5,000%, was charged with 8 separate counts of securities fraud, conspiracy to commit securities fraud, and wire fraud for his role in managing 2 hedge funds between 2009 and 2014 before he became the CEO of Turing. The government alleged he stole $11 million from a company he founded to pay back investors that he had defrauded, with allegations that he claimed to have $40 million in one fund when he actually had about $300. The defense claims...
Whoops. Yeah.
That's an issue.
I'm no SEC lawyer, but is that frowned upon? Is that bad? If someone would have just said that was frowned upon, then maybe it would be a different story. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, he just didn't balance his checkbook for a while.
Yes, yes.
So the defense claimed that some investors actually did really well in investing with Shkreli and that no one really was harmed. And sometimes these investors doubled or even tripled their investments. As we know and have talked about previously on our show, Shkreli did not really help his cause by being openly defiant and vocal about his trial with the press and had a very significant presence on social media during the trial. However, he actually decided not to testify at trial, which was probably a good thing for him. The defense claimed they were 90% pleased with the decision and that nobody ever really lost anything through Shkreli's acts. And we are just waiting on the sentencing right now, which is expected to be, he's expected to get about a year.
At Club Fed, the great part is he said that he's looking forward to it almost because he said he's going to a Club Fed where he can play Xbox and tennis.
He'll be on Facebook Live.
Yeah.
He'll be on Instagram Live.
And his lawyer said, we're not 100% pleased, but we're 90% pleased. I mean, they're spinning this like it's a big win.
It's a good thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, has there been anyone in recent memory that the public wants to punch in the face more than this guy?
The look on his face, that smug smile.
The haircut and, yeah, great stuff. Thank you, Shkreli.
I have a feeling we'll be hearing from him quite a bit.
We will.
On to number two, we have some legal troubles for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, this is a new segment. This is a Netanyahu watch, baby.
Pretty much.
We have Trump watch. We got to start a Israel. Maybe we are big in Israel, I understand. Our ratings on Legal Face-Off are huge in the Tel Aviv and the Jerusalem markets.
The tens and dozens of people that listen to it.
Yeah, so we're adding some Israeli coverage. Netanyahu, who's one of the longest-serving leaders in the world, is facing some legal issues. He's got a variety of alleged bribery, misconduct, some fraud allegations. Just this week, his former chief of staff became a state witness in a corruption case, which is not a good sign. His wife is being investigated for basically pay for play. The allegation against the prime minister is that he accepted many gifts in exchange for access, in exchange for press coverage.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it sounds a little close to home. Interestingly, the former prime minister, Netanyahu's predecessor, just got out of jail for similar charges, literally taking envelopes full of money from people who want access to the government. So hard times in Israel. He, of course, has alleged that this is all a witch hunt. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
There is no provision in the Israeli constitution compelling his resignation. So this will take some time. But, yeah, interesting stuff going on in the U.S.'s biggest ally in the Middle East.
Well, let's not forget that his son is being sued for libel.
Let's hard not times. Forget that. I did not know that. I didn't know that, but I will also not forget it.
Hard times in the Netanyahu family.
Yeah, come on. Everyone knows about the libel suit by the prime minister's son.
Let's bring it back to Chicago. The police department has been investigated in multiple ways by the U.S. Justice Department. Guess what the bill is right now?
It is a whopping $5.7 million.
That's it. Yeah, that's a lot of money to investigate to spend on the Chicago PD.
Firms are doing pretty well.
Yes.
Not the TV show either. The actual PD.
So last week the Sun-Times reported that the legal and consulting fees associated with the Department of Justice's investigation of the Chicago Police Department so far total $5.7 million. This total does not include any of the fees and costs incurred since Mayor Emanuel drafted a memorandum of agreement to try to avoid federal court oversight. That memorandum of agreement has not yet been released to the press. The costs are actually expected to rise even more in the coming weeks, given that the DOJ negotiations are still continuing. And the city is defending itself against a class action that was filed by lawyers for Black Lives Matter Chicago and other community groups who are seeking federal oversight over the Chicago Police Department. The lawsuit alleges that Mayor Emanuel reneged on his commitment to negotiate a consent decree and instead attempted to cut a backroom deal with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who opposes court oversight over local police departments. So it'll be interesting to keep our eyes on this one.
Yeah, these are all, I mean, let's be clear. These are all fees going to outside firms, legal and consulting fees. Ironically, the Justice Department probe that has already cost the city a ton of money and all of these settlements resulting from alleged police brutality has resulted in, you know, tens of millions of dollars in settlements. This continues to run up the tab on all of these issues.
President Trump has picked a new U.S. attorney for Chicago, John Lausch. What do we know about Lausch?
So Lausch last Thursday was announced as Chicago's new U.S. attorney. He's currently a partner at Kirkland & Ellis, where he handles corporate investigations and complex litigation. He was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District from 1999 to 2010. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago is one of the busiest in the nation with a wide variety of cases, including financial fraud, political corruption, terrorism, and gang conspiracies. At this stage, Trump needs to send Lausch's nomination to the Senate, which must then confirm him. If he is confirmed, he will formally succeed Zach Farden. Lausch is actually from Joliet and was born and raised there and played football at Harvard and was admitted to the Illinois bar in 1996.
He was captain of Joliet Catholic, Sam.
He's a Hilltopper.
Yeah. By all accounts, a good pick. He was on the short list now for a few weeks. Unclear whether he's a Republican or Democrat. There was an interesting piece on Chicago Tonight last night with some former U.S. attorneys, and they asked whether Lausch is Republican. And, you know, quite pointedly, the former U.S. attorney said, we don't know. That never comes up. You know, but just because he's appointed by a Republican, Trump, doesn't mean that he's Republican. We don't ever talk about that kind of thing. So, yeah, looks like he'll be a good pick. Some were disappointed that a female was not picked. There was a female who was on the short list. Maggie Hickey, who was an inspector general, but Trump went with you know, someone who had the experience in the U.S. Attorney's Office. He also headed up, you might have mentioned this, but he headed up the gang unit for very many years, so that's expected to be one of his foremost goals early on, is to deal with the plague of gangs in Chicago.
We've got some lawsuits with the Cook County soda pop tax, McDonald's, Walgreens, and 7-Eleven, among many others that will probably follow, getting hit hard. People are upset. They don't want to pay that extra tax on their pop.
Yeah, no surprise here. Tanya Trish, who is the general counsel for the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, was on our show recently talking about the Cook County sweetened beverage tax, and she predicted that if this tax went through, she, of course, was fighting on behalf of her organization to prevent this tax. She said that if this tax goes through, there'll be a rash of lawsuits due to the unconstitutionality of it and due to the confusion. Well, sure enough, in the short time that we've now had the tax, it's been about 10 days, we've seen, as you mentioned, Sam, a rash of lawsuits. McDonald's has been sued, Walgreens, 7-Eleven, for a variety of reasons. Everything from, you know, someone suing Walgreens for taxing unsweetened sparkling water to a class action against McDonald's for adding the tax before calculating other taxes.
You mean there's something wrong with taxing a tax?
Yeah, I mean, who knew?
They're taxing refills now at restaurants. Did you know that?
Yeah, I mean,
you go in and get a pop. It used to be free refills. Now you have to pay for it and you get taxed.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there will be inevitably lawsuits resulting from it. It's brand new. There will be some confusion in the rollout. This week, Tony Preckwinkel, who's the chairman of the Cook County, she dropped her lawsuit. She was suing IRMA, Illinois Retail Merchants Association, for $17 million, saying that the month delay as a result of the lawsuit that was later thrown out resulted in a loss of taxes to Cook County to the tune of $17 million. Well, when the court this week decided to drop the appeal or not allow the appeal, she in turn dropped the lawsuit she had against IRMA. So there'll be some lawsuits. I don't think this rises to the level of class action, you know, a few pennies, but people like our former friend, former co-host, Jason Whiteside.
I was waiting.
We'll take these kind of cases all the time. We got to give Whiteside a shout out.
Whatever happened to Jason?
Who knows?
I saw him last week at a golf outing. Swear to God.
Yes. Jason and I talked today. All right, let's keep moving here.
Two more, and we'll roll through them. Eric Bolling has been suspended from Fox.
Yeah. The sexual harassment allegations that we've covered on our show extensively at Fox, including having one of the plaintiff's lawyers on the show recently, continues. Eric Bolling was host of The Specialist, former host of The Five, who has now been suspended pending an investigation that he sent lewd messages to multiple coworkers. He has denied it, but according to at least two, as the source goes, of his female colleagues at Fox Business and one at Fox News, he sent pictures of his private parts to these women. He has denied it. The investigation continues. You will inevitably see a lawsuit against Bolling and against Fox News resulting from it. It's not a good look for Fox News, obviously. And the presumption, given that Roger Ailes resigned or was fired, given Bill O'Reilly left or was fired, the presumption will be that this is true.
Last one. Taylor Swift, musical phenom, is involved in the middle of a groping trial. Yes, I said groping trial.
Are you
not
a fan
the first
of Taylor
time
Swift?
We've said groping on Legal Face Off?
I don't mind her. She's okay.
Okay.
You a T-Swift?
Rich?
I was saving the favorite Taylor Swift questions. but since you stepped all over my outro. Yeah, I love Taylor Swift. Love T-Swift. I'm a big Swifty.
Nice.
Saw her in concert. Yeah. Favorite song, Sam?
22? Is that a song?
Yeah.
Or Feeling 22 or something?
17, something like that.
Some number.
Yeah. She said she was 17, Sam. She was actually 22. Was
no, it's 22. Are they,
is it 22?
I think that's a song.
Yeah.
I don't
like Blank
time.
Space.
Nice.
You know, yeah.
No
so favorite song for you?
No, I don't have a favorite song.
All this time to prepare, and that was the one... The one question you couldn't predict.
Yeah, well, no, I'm actually going to come out and say I'm not a Taylor Swift fan,
right.
So I'm going to stand by that.
Very talented young lady.
But I can talk about her case.
Yeah.
So trial began Monday in federal court in Denver in a case involving Taylor Swift and a Denver DJ who purportedly groped her during a pre-concert event in 2013. David Mueller, who was subsequently fired from his job at KYGO-FM in Denver, said under oath this week that the photo of him with Swift appears, quote, weird and awkward, but he denied her allegations that he inappropriately touched her. In 2015, Mueller sued Taylor Swift and her mother, along with her radio promotions director, alleging that Swift's false accusation led to his termination. She then countersued, claiming sexual assault. Yesterday, both Mueller and Swift's mother, as well as her promotions director, all testified at trial. Mueller's testimony yesterday related to where his hands were during the photo op, and her mother claimed during her testimony that Swift was groped and sexually assaulted. Mueller claims he didn't grope her, but that someone else from the meet and greet probably did. He claims this incident cost him his career and income and has been very hard on his family and friends, and he wants to clear his name. He's seeking $3 million in damages, whereas Swift is only seeking a verdict that awards her a dollar. She said that it's about making an example to other women who go through similar situations and who resist taking further action to address those sorts of activities.
Yeah, he testified for 5 hours yesterday, and they showed the picture of him with his arm around her, and his arm, as the Taylor Swift's attorneys pointed out, was, you know, not around traditionally where you would put it, sort of the back. It was near her rear end. And he said it was a quick photo, and his hand was sort of on the way to being, you know, going up. So this,
they talked about that for 5 hours.
Oh my God, yeah. It was you know, interesting testimony. But yeah, I mean, she's out to prove a point. I think it's going to be hard to prove. It's going to come down, as many of these cases do, to credibility, right? So there's no evidence of exactly what happened, except for the people who were there.
That about does it for Legal Face-Off.
Play us off with a little Shake It Off.
Take maybe. Us out. 22 yeah. is a song, by the 22. Way. It's called 22, yes. For Rich and Tina, I'm Sam. Thanks to Craig Collins as well for all of our guests. You can find the podcast on WGNRadio.com and on iTunes, and we'll talk to you next time on Legal Face-Off.